our vision for Alaska overlapped so much that there was little differentiation between us.
Bill Walker and Byron Mallott join forces to try to defeat Sean Parnell. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a British adventurer talks about her epic Alaskan and world adventure.
We're often held back by fear of change, failure, not being good enough, blah, 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 blah. And it's all blah, blah to me. I just think, well, go and have a go.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Bill Walker and Byron Mallott campaigns have joined forces to try to defeat Governor Sean Parnell in November. They're calling their combined campaign the Alaska First Unity Ticket. The pair announced their decision at a packed press conference today in Anchorage. KSKA's Ann Hillman has more.
Walker agreed to drop his Republican affiliation to run for governor with Democrat Byron Mallott as his running mate. Walker previously ran as an independent. Both Hollis French and Craig Fleener, who were candidates for lieutenant governor, will step aside. Mallott says it was not an easy choice to make, but he didn't think either of them could beat Parnell on their own. Mallott says he doesn't feel like he's abandoning the people who voted for him in the primary.
It's hard in political life to ask for this because of recent or a long history, but we're trying to change that. And I ask you to trust me. Look at my record. Look at what I say. Look at the actions I take. I cannot do anything more.
The pair's main message is that they're working together to build Alaska and to go against partisan politics.
Our vision for Alaska was part of the problem in the campaign. They overlapped so much that there was little differentiation between us.
Walker says he's still socially conservative, but he says they're not running the campaign on social issues. Instead, they have agreed to focus on improving the economy and the education system. He says one way to do that is to actually decide which mega projects the state wants to complete, like the Alaska LNG project.
We need to stop doing some of the crazy studies we do. We spend billions of dollars on studies and we don't actually do something. We just study the studies of the studies. We need to decide what we can do, what we're going to do. We need to do them. We need to stop studying everything else.
Walker says he does not have other specific ideas for budget cuts. He assured the group that Mallott would be an active part of the decision-making process and would have a place in the governor's office if they win, not next door. Luke Miller with the Parnell campaign says they're not surprised by the move.
They're both, you know, the way we see it, two peas in a pod. They've both supported a lot of these liberal Obama policies here in Alaska, whether it's expanding Obamacare, raising taxes, or growing government.
Miller says Parnell's campaign is still waiting to hear specifics from the new unity ticket on their actual policy proposals. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell's office just released a decision approving the combined ticket of Bill Walker and Byron Mallott. This means the pair can legally continue their campaign for the office of governor and lieutenant governor in the lead-up to November's election. The campaign of Senator Mark Begich has taken down a controversial TV ad entitled Crime Scene that began airing Friday. The ad featured a retired Anchorage police officer who says Republican Senate candidate Dan Sullivan let sex offenders off with light sentences.
One of them got out of prison, is now charged with breaking into that apartment building, murdering a senior couple, and sexually assaulting their two-year-old granddaughter.
It essentially blames Sullivan for the 2013 crime because he was attorney general when the suspect cut a plea deal for a prior crime that resulted in a short sentence. Sullivan immediately responded with a rebuttal ad, calling the Begich ad shameful and unfounded.
The failure that led to active release occurred before I even became attorney general.
The double murder case hasn't yet gone to trial. but the Department of Law previously acknowledged the suspect would probably still be in prison if it were not for a mistake when he was sentenced for a prior crime. The department found a state prosecutor in 2010 relied on an inaccurate report of the suspect's criminal history, resulting in a deal and a 4-year sentence. Because the suspect had a prior felony, the sentence by state law should have been at least double that. Sullivan's campaign says he bears no responsibility for the erroneous report. The Begich campaign counters by circulating an image of the 2010 plea deal that resulted in the short sentence. Sullivan was AG then, and his name is on the bottom of the document. Both campaigns took down their ads after a request by the victim's family. University of Alaska President Pat Gamble has requested the Board of Regents review a $320,000 retention incentive the board approved for him in June. The request comes amid a surge of public criticism as the university works to address budgetary issues as state funding declines. The retention incentive would be awarded at the end of Gamble's 3-year contract in May of 2016. The Board of Regents is expected to address the request at a September 8th meeting in Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, young farmers near Talkeetna are starting small but thinking big.
Our main goal is to feed the residents of Talkeetna, and anything on top of that is good too.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at SmileAlaska.com.
Southeast residents will be able to buy locally milled lumber in the future as small-scale timber sales begin on Mitkoff Island. The trees are mostly from young-growth stands comprised of what some would call trash wood. KFSK's Elizabeth Jenkins reports on how small local mills are transforming that notion.
Chris Fry isn't superficial when it comes to logs. As a small mill operator, he says it's necessary to look beyond the bark surface.
It's good to be able to look at these logs and say, yeah, I know there's a good patch of wood in there and I can get some good stuff out of that one.
This way of thinking is fairly new. Fry has been in the milling business for 14 years, mostly in Washington State. He says a larger mill operator would take a glance at a knotty piece of spruce and make a judgment call.
They're going to take a look at that log and they're going, we're not going to cut it, it's too ugly, and they'll throw it over in their firewood.
But Fry assesses it and sees dollar signs. Like a skilled butcher, he knows how to parcel up the cuts to sell for maximum profit. He glides a bandsaw over a 10-foot piece of spruce, rotating the sides until it's a smooth block. From there, it will be divided into trim or decking. Fry also supplies salvage pieces for installation art, and he uses alder, or what he calls music wood, to make guitars. He's part of a growing number of mill operators who can use their skills for more specialized projects.
There's a lot of these small mills around. There's a lot of people who are getting into doing this because the small mills can do jobs that the big mills just can't.
That's because the big mills are under a time crunch. They crank out orders and need a large supply of logs to turn a profit. What Fry is doing operates more like a boutique.
I don't mind spending the extra time. I can do that and still make money at this.
The Petersburg Economic Development Council also saw this venture as an opportunity to diversify the local economy. But for it to work, there would have to be a steady supply of timber. So when the Forest Service announced they would be optioning micro-logging sales on Mitkoff Island, it seemed like the perfect opportunity for small mill operators. There was only one thing missing, says PEDC coordinator Liz Cabrera.
During those discussions, we realized that part of the problem was that they really had never had to sell the products on the market.
Enter Chris Fry, experienced small mill operator, and now the marketing liaison for the project Alaska Mills. The PEDC was recently awarded over $23,000 from the National Forest Foundation, which they're using to fund Fry's expertise. He'll put other small mill operators in touch with clients from the lower 48, even Asia. The timber sale on Mickhoff is unique because it's optioning a lot of young growth trees.
What we're doing is making sure that we're not taking these big, huge clear cuts. They're more thinning type operations. And then that wood will be sold, some of it locally and some of it down south.
Adam Liljeblad is the Director of Conservation Awards at the National Forest Foundation, a nonprofit with the slogan, Protecting America's Backyard. He says small-scale logging operations like this provide sustainability.
There's a lot more care being taken to ensure that smart land management decisions are being made.
Small mill operators will have access to hemlock, red cedar, and yellow cedar. Fry says the alder grows like an invasive weed.
It's actually going to grow faster than we're going to be able to take it down.
He says Mickhoff is covered in it. Alder is an orange, knotty-looking wood that's become popular for furniture and cabinet making. 10 years ago, it went by a less dignified name.
They called it trash wood for alder and things like that. It's just garbage wood is what they considered it. People cut it for firewood, but it's actually a really good marketable wood. And actually in Washington right now, the price of alder logs is higher than the price of Doug fir logs.
Small mill operators are proving that certain logs aren't trash. You just have to see the profit within. In Petersburg, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Last month, the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge announced it was thinking about temporarily suspending brown bear sport hunting on the refuge until late next spring. Last week, they held two public meetings to see how people felt about the proposal, and on Friday, they made their decision. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Brown bear hunting on the refuge is done, at least for now. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees the refuge, said the closure is being implemented as a resource protection measure. The feds maintain that the documented levels of human-caused mortality the past few years, especially in 2013 and 2014, are causing too steep a decline in the population. Some of that increased kill rate can be attributed to decisions made by the State Board of Game last year when it voted to expand harvest limits. At the public meeting held in Soldotna, Board Chair Ted Spraker explained some of the reasoning behind that decision.
We hear the phrase all the time that bears have a low reproductive potential, but it seems to me they never finish the sentence. They also have a very high survival rate of cubs and yearlings, and they're long-lived animals. When I worked for the department, I handled several bears that were over 30 years of age and still productive. So bears are very productive, and they're very long-lived animals.
There is a bit of a rift between the opinions at the federal and state levels about A, just exactly how many brown bears are on the Kenai, and B, how successfully that population is maintained. The state feels there are enough brown bears to support the hunting seasons that it's laid out, and that meeting the recently adopted cap of 70 bears a year won't do much to hurt that. But the feds point to the fact that Kenai brown bears are a unique brand of ursine. Not exactly a coastal population, but not really a mainland one either. They say this makes them more susceptible to things like disease and changes in habitat, as the gene pool isn't as deep and can't be added to as easily as other populations. But State Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Doug Vincent Lang isn't buying it.
The federal closure appears more based on management philosophy and ethics than resource conservation and does not fall within the mandates of cooperative management that Congress envisioned when it redesignated the Kenai Refuge. In this and other wildlife-related closures, the service has repeatedly stated that such actions are resource protection measures necessary to ensure consistency with refuge purposes, including the purpose of maintaining natural diversity.
The big problem there, Vincent Lang said, is that term natural diversity. The Fish and Wildlife Service defines it as the number and relative abundance of indigenous species which would occur without human interference. But the state finds that to be too vague, especially here, where what they really want to know is how many bears are needed to maintain that diversity. Because the state's mandate is essentially to give reasonable harvest opportunities when there are enough bears. If the refuge is able to make that kind of decision unilaterally, Vincent Lang wondered, where does it stop?
With brown bears, wolves, moose, hare, grouse, berry picking? I don't believe that it was ever the intent of Congress to allow the federal government to hold such power over fish and wildlife that have long been recognized as state resources, even if they happen to occur in federally administered lands.
So what happens now? The refuge says it will continue to work with the Department of Fish and Game to find a set of metrics they can all agree on to measure the brown bear population, with the hope that they can go to the Board of Game next year with a plan that everyone likes. Refuge biologist John Morton said they would like the focus of any management plan to be on keeping the number of reproductive aged females to a minimum, as that number has grown steadily over the past few years. The temporary closure of the hunt is set to expire on May 31st of 2015. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here.
Former University of Alaska Anchorage Athletic Director Steve Cobb died last night in Florida. He was 55 years old. The cause of death is unknown. UAA Sports Information Director Nate Sagan worked with Cobb during his entire 13-year tenure. He says Cobb constantly worked to improve the lives of student athletes by striving for excellence, both in athletics and in the classroom.
The goal was always to get our student athletes to a 3.2 combined GPA. And towards the end of his tenure, I think we finally did reach that goal. And I know that was one of his proudest days. As a Seawolf, seeing that 3.2 on the final printout.
Cobb made several changes in the department, including moving the gymnastics program to the Division I level and pushing for the creation of the Seawolf Hall of Fame. Sagan says Cobb was instrumental in the creation of the Alaska Airlines Center.
It is ironic that this week where we're opening this brand new beautiful building, which he had so much influence in having built, and it's kind of sad that he's not around to witness it even from a distance.
Cobb was the athletic director at UAA from 2000 to 2013. He was fired during a tumultuous off-season when questions arose over his handling of an incident where former hockey coach Dave Shiak was accused of hitting a player with his stick. A British adventurer is making her way around the world in a human-powered craft. She's rowing, kayaking, and biking from London back to London. She arrived in Homer 2 weeks ago after kayaking up the Aleutian Chain. Over the weekend, she started the next phase of her journey, a 6,000-mile bike ride from Alaska to the East Coast. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver was there when she left and has this story.
The first thing that strikes you about Sarah Ooten is that she's extraordinarily normal.
To me, I'm not really fussed about records or speeds or miles or all of that. It's just about the adventure.
Despite what she's doing, she's not intimidating. She's about average height and average build, with an open face and an inviting smile. She's one of those people that instantly makes you feel like friends.
One thing, actually, people often say is, I could never do anything like you're doing. And it makes me sad when I hear that, because I think really we can, kind of anyone can do whatever they want to do if they put their mind to it and maybe make some sacrifices or changes to things to allow them to do whatever it is. But I think we're often held back by fear of change, failure, not being good enough, blah, 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 blah. And it's all blah, blah to me. I just think, well, go and have a go.
She decided to have a go at an around-the-world trek on April Fool's Day in 2011. She left from under the Tower Bridge in London, traveled by boat from Britain to France, biked across Europe, Asia, and Russia, and rode across the ocean to Adak. From there, she kayaked up the Aleutians and landed in Homer 101 days later at the Mariners Memorial on the Homer Spit.
It actually feels really fitting and special to have landed here, because the sea is such a part of my life and my journey, and it's obviously such an intrinsic part of Homer life. And so to incorporate that as my sort of mark between one phase and the next feels special.
Uten says she's picky about starting the next phase from the same spot, so she's standing under the memorial with her trusty bike loaded up and ready to go.
This is my bike Hercules, the adventure bike, if you will. For the bike geeks out there, which I'm sure there are a few, it's a Santos Travelmaster 2.8 Alu. I have no idea what that means.
She got Hercules from a friend who offered him up for free.
And he's a touring bike, so he's kind of strong and chunky, can cope with the bags that I put on there to store all my stuff.
She talks about Hercules like she talks about her life and this journey. It's unpredictable, usually reliable, but in the end, it's all part of the adventure.
Oh, Hercules is was chosen because I wanted a nice, strong name to carry me across all the miles. And at that point in my life, I didn't want to ride 10,000 miles on a girl, so I gave him a boy's name. Then I fell in love with a woman. What can I say?
That woman she's talking about is Lucy. Along with traveling halfway around the world, Uten has become engaged in the last 3 years. She says she knows her family and friends back home worry about her. She says her mother's gotten a bit grayer, and her own perspective has changed too. The distance has made her more eager to be back at home with her loved ones.
I would never have considered just flying home to see somebody at the start of the journey, but since I met Lucy, who's now my fiancé, well, that puts a whole new perspective on everything. So I flew home after we landed in Homer to surprise her for her birthday, and that's the most magic thing to me. So, you know, some people like to go for records and fastest and this, that and the other, and that's all well and good for them. But for me, it's about being in the journey.
She's invited local bikers to come along on the first part of this next leg, and dozens of them dutifully show up to escort her out of Homer to the start of her 6,000-mile cycle across the country.
Okay, is everybody ready? Yay! Yay! Let's go!
And this is what stands out about Sarah Uten, the woman traveling solo around the world. It's the fact that she is so normal, so human, that makes her extraordinary. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The average farmer in the U.S. is nearly 60 years old. Three young and idealistic Alaskans are defying that trend with a new farm near Talkeetna. Bear Hands Organic Farm is only 1 acre, but its owners have big plans. KTNA's Philip Manning has the story.
Bear Hands Farm, like much of the Upper Valley's farmland, is a little out of the way. After leaving the Talkeetna Spur Road and driving a few miles over gravel, then through a series of private driveways, I made it there after only getting lost once. I was met by two of the three people who operate the farm.
Well, I'm Graham Knapp.
And I'm Mindy Sykes.
The third partner in Bear Hands Farm is John Sargent, who works in Bethel but is planning on spending more time on the farm in future seasons. In a time when the federal government says the average age of a farmer is 57, the trio represent an infusion of youth into the agriculture industry. Graham Knapp says he sees what Bear Hands Farm is doing as part of a larger trend within his generation.
I think there is a movement out there with young people that want to diversify a little bit and create farms that are more community-oriented and where typically, you know, you wouldn't find other small farms. So They just want to kind of infuse the community with fresh local food.
Mindy Sykes's reasons for getting involved in small-scale farming are rather similar to what Graham describes.
For me, it's probably just my love for food and good food and becoming more aware of how my food was grown and not wanting to partake of that. And choosing to be a part of, you know, how food, in my opinion, can be and should be grown.
While Bear Hands Farm does produce a variety of vegetables, including zucchini, turnips, and leafy greens, one of the ways that the owners have found to break into the market is by thinking small, as I discover when we walk into the greenhouse.
Primarily, we've been using this for our microgreens operation.
Microgreens are basically exactly what they sound like, as Graham Knapp explains.
When a plant first comes up, it's got its first two leaves called the cotyledons, and then the first true leaves, when those come in, You can harvest then, and those are considered microgreens.
The microgreens are grown from a number of edible plants, and it's possible to substitute them as ingredients in a salad, but that takes a lot of them. So Graham says that restaurants like to use them as a garnish or to add an edible visual element to a meal.
We like to add color and find the ones that have some color to it, and we find that the restaurants like that as a aesthetic quality to their plates.
Bare Hands Farm currently sells to two local restaurants, Twister Creek and the Talkeetna Alaskan Lodge. Mindy Sykes says that there has been interest from other businesses, but the growing capacity will have to expand in order to take on additional customers.
Other restaurants were interested in buying our microgreens and using them as well, but really just the brewery and the lodge with our little greenhouse was enough for
okay.
us. But in the future, with our larger greenhouse and kind of dialing it in a little bit more, we'd love to be able to provide that to more people.
After looking at the greenhouse, Graham and Mindy took me to the vegetable rows where they have a mix of leafy greens, root vegetables, and even one pumpkin that produced fruit. Graham Knapp says that selling the vegetables to restaurants is something that might happen in the future, but it's not the primary goal right now.
Our main goal is to feed the residents of Talkeetna, and anything on top of that is good too.
For now, feeding Talkeetnans largely means selling at a local farmer's market during the summer. While expansion is definitely being considered, Graham Knapp says that it doesn't necessarily take a lot of land to get a larger yield.
It's amazing how much food you can grow in a small area.
Right.
Like we're putting out a lot of food on under an acre. And, you know, we had tossed around some numbers, you know, how big do we want to get, 2 or 3 or 5 acres? But mm-hmm. that is so much food when you're growing right.
One of the biggest challenges that faces Alaskan farmers is the short growing season. Graham Knapp says he wants to try different methods for extending that season to provide vegetables later in the year.
I really want to experiment with kind of growing into the fall a little bit more with the high tunnels that we have coming in, and then starting things really early and extending the seasons a lot more.
My tour of Bare Hands Farm ended at the chicken enclosure, where more than 24 birds were sheltering from the drizzle that had begun. Some of the birds have recently begun laying eggs, and many more will start soon. Graham and Mindy are also raising the chickens for meat, both for nutritional and ethical reasons.
Mindy and I have kind of sworn off industrial meat just because we know it's not, you know, treated very well.
And it's not good for you.
Yeah.
The omega-3 to 6s are off because they're eating food they're not supposed to be eating. So it's really not the best.
As the tour concluded and I got into my truck to drive away, Graham Knapp and Mindy Sykes went immediately back to work, making the most of what's left of the Alaskan summer at Bare Hands Farm. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jennifer Canfield in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins in Petersburg, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Didn't quite catch that report. Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.